door. Back door. Back door. Back door. All right.
Why? Why do? Why does it filter out? Why do they? L. E. Let. Us. S. T. A. Stay. On the air.
Why do they let us stay on the air? Well, that's a very good question. I think for one thing, they don't want, when KPFA went off in the air, when they had their thing back in, I guess it was 99, they had 10,000 people on the streets. Mm. And I think Bush just doesn't really want to go shutting down radio stations right now. I think he's got a lot of other things on his mind at the moment. But for some reason, they just seem unwilling to shut down micro stations in the Bay Area.
It. S. E. E. It seems like it is D A N dangerous for them not to shut us down.
I don't know. I think we're just such a little tiny gnat for them I think they just haven't bothered with us yet. I mean, they have shut down micro stations in other parts of the country, but for some reason, they seem like they have been just real reluctant to shut down any here in the Bay Area. There's us, there's Berkeley Liberation Radio, there's Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we've all been on the air for years now, and they haven't come and shut us down.
I have a theory as to why. As far as I can tell, I think the government knows that you can keep people more quiet and satisfied if you throw them the occasional bone. If they were unequivocally not letting any unlicensed radio stations on the air, it would be more obvious how much they're trying to stop people from having a voice. Mm-hmm. So by letting these little radio stations stay in the air, they can say, look, we're not totally against you, and I mean, the truth is, like, we don't get out to that many people. And if we became more powerful and did, they might care more. They certainly would, depending on whether we were interfering with other stations or not. But this is kind of a cheap bone they can throw, in a way. And I think that's one of the reasons why they let it continue to happen.
Mm-hmm. And another thing to consider is... And Banikin Taco is on the air, despite the fact that he's got a court order now against him, telling him not to broadcast, but he continues to broadcast, and they haven't shut him down yet.
He, Jay, just, L, A, laughs.
He just laughs? Oh, yeah, he just laughs at him. Yeah, he doesn't care. I mean, they came out to his home and, kind of ransacked his home and his. But yeah, you're right. Basically, they just laughed at him, and they were right back on the air. Yeah.
I. A. S. I asked. T. O. Mike Townsend. If I was T not, oh, if you weren't, Frank asked Mike Townsend, with Mabana.
Mm-hmm, right.
He asked Mike if if I, Frank, weren't a Crip, would I be dead by now? That's what he asked, what Mike's theory about that was. We, Jay, and we had just aired, I don't know, I can't remember the guy's name, but we had just aired something on Lover about this guy that was a real muckraker, and Mikey, can you fill us in on this now?
I can't remember his name.
But the story.
Right, he was the, he became the editor of like the Miami Herald or something, and they were about to break all this corruption stuff about mafia involvement.
Mm-hmm. He did. He did some books. That was what he was promoting, the books he had written about E.L. election fraud. That was it. Uh-huh.
This is somebody you had on here?
No, we had an old cable access show. Oh, you know, people like give us tapes all the time. So this was like a few years old when this guy was on a cable access show somewhere in the country talking about this book that he had written that was apparently a bestseller, where he exposed election fraud.
Fraud in Florida?
In Florida, yes. Mm-hmm. And, right. He brought cameras in to, kind of a bunch of, was it the League of Women Voters or something, you know, where they were processing votes, and they were just manufacturing the votes. And it was all on the video. He got it all on video. He aired the video. Uh-huh. And he was, he was a journalist. He was very detailed. And the whole book was just more and more examples of it like that. He was all after R.E. Reno.
Oh, he was after Janet Reno. Uh-huh.
So, and then...
Yeah, well, I mean, Florida seems to have a chronic case of voter fraud going for them.
So he bought or something the Miami Herald, is that right? And he was, so he's editor now, and he's ready to break these big election fraud stories. He was about to S-T-A start P.U. publishing. He was about to start publishing the paper, right? Mm-hmm. This was going to be like the big kind of premiere of him as editor with these big stories. Well, like 2 days before it, he came down with a deadly disease and died.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. And, I mean, he didn't die right then, but the paper never happened because he came down with this out of nowhere, you know, and shortly after died.
And he died.
Yeah. And so, I was like, whoa, when we watched that on Lover. Richard Collier, that might have been his name. So,
was there an official explanation? Or did they just say, we have no idea what caused his death?
He died of cancer.
It was a cancer. It was a weird...
And when did this happen?
This was
97.
Yeah, something like that.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. So then we started thinking about, that's when Frank started asking, because Frank has been, causing trouble, for 30 years. And he was investigated by Jesse Helms in the early 90s. He was one of that handful of artists. Mm-hmm. And so that's when he said, I wonder if I was a Crip, if I wasn't a Crip, if I'd be dead by now. Because that was right after that story.
Huh.
And so we asked Mike Townsend what he thought of that, and he says Mabana often says that he thinks that if he wasn't disabled, he might not be dead, but he would at least be something. What was it? In jail. That's right. He'd at least be in jail.
There's certainly a possibility of, think about it from a prosecutor's point of view. If you're going to drag an African American who's blind in, put him in front of a jury and say, send this guy to jail.
Right.
Yeah.
when Frank was investigated by Jesse Helms, our fantasy was that they would call Frank in front of the Senate, you know?
If they would call Frank.
Frank in front of the Senate about, you know, about his art, because we knew Jesse Helms had no idea that Frank was disabled. You know, we knew he knew really nothing about him, so.
And he wouldn't have known until you came into the courtroom.
Yeah, yeah, so we imagined, our fantasy was this dramatic entrance, you know, and how bad he would look and all that. Always have F you fun. You always have fun with those situations.
Yeah.
The other artists that were invested, the five artists, they all kind of got stressed out by it and got really upset and eventually, you know. And Frank, on the other hand, just thought this was a party. You know, he had so much fun with it. He wrote an open letter to Jesse Helms.
Was this like when they were, that Robert Mapplethorpe guy?
So it was like Andy Sprinkle and Karen Finley and Johanna Wendt and Frank and John Fleck. There was like five artists, I think.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. But the thing was, all the other artists got money from the government for their art. So they had like a real, they had real things at risk. You know, they would, like,
was
stop
this,
having money.
Was it NEA grants?
Yeah. Well, actually, Annie didn't. Annie didn't get money from the government, but she got booked at places that got money from the government. Mm-hmm. So that was, I was always the B, A, bad, B, bad boy.
Always the bad boy.
Yeah, Frank wasn't getting booked at any of those places that got money from the government anyway. Yeah. So he didn't really have anything to lose but to have a good time with it. And in fact, they actually started booking him after this because they didn't want to be seen as being on the same side as Jesse Helms. So for a short
period. Way to go, Frank.
S. So. When. What? Where? Did? Where did you see? Oh, come from?
Where did what?
Where did you come from?
Where did I come from? San Francisco. What do you mean, tonight or originally? Well,
how did he get started?
Yeah. Before.
How did I get started with the radio station?
Yes. Like before the RA, before the radio station.
Oh, well, I came to San Francisco in 1990, around the time Saddam Hussein, Iraq invaded Kuwait, and the U.S. was transporting troops to the Middle East, and that was actually kind of where the radio station, you know, has its roots, actually, in a way.
Where? Where from? You came to San Francisco from where?
Well, I'm originally from Tennessee, but I was living down in Southern California right before I came up here.
Where in Southern California?
Orange County. I got a lot of stories about the wild and woolly days of Orange County.
How did you get to Orange County?
Well, I kind of migrated out to California from Tennessee in the mid-1980s, and I was, just to reveal something personal about my life at that time, I was homeless and living in my vehicle with my dog. And we were, I joined a poetry reading group in Orange County that met at the Laguna Beach Public Library. This really nice lady organized it. What they would normally do was they would have a main, they met once a week, and they would have a main featured reader, and then an open mic afterwards in which anybody could get up and read their poems. Well, after hearing me read a couple of times, she invited me to be the featured reader one night. And, you know, Orange County is, of course, very famous for being sort of a rock-ribbed conservative area, which I wasn't quite totally conscious about this when I first landed there. Anyway, some of my poems are, you know, kind of radical, and I write, you know, anti-war poems and stuff like that. And I got up and read a few of my poems, and I noticed that there was a... I noticed there was a certain few people in the audience who just had a really negative, just seemed to have a fierce antipathy to some of my poems. And it started, my night there as a featured reader just broke out into complete chaos and pandemonium. And they were didn't like my poetry at all.
A. S. U. Success.
Yeah, I guess in a way it was. But I found out that I had defenders there in the audience as well. And somehow the subject of fascism, I was reading a poem called 20th Anniversary, Kent State, Ohio. And this was the year which, you know, it actually had been the 20th anniversary. So I read that poem, and these two guys, I had, you know, there were basically two guys who were members of the group who just didn't like, you know, the poems that I read. And I read Kent's, this poem I wrote about Kent State, and they just totally kind of blew up. And somehow, the subject of fascism came up, and... one of these people put forth the sort of novel idea that fascism was a phenomenon associated entirely with Mussolini, and that after Mussolini had died, fascism just kind of disappeared from the world. And then, you know, there was an African American guy who was in the group, and he just got up and said, "Man, you don't know fuck about fascism." And all of a sudden, just all hell broke loose.
Wow.
So after that, I quit going to poetry reading groups, and I also decided that Orange County probably just wasn't the place for me, and that's when I came up to San Francisco.
You'd heard the tales of liberal Northern California?
They, the liberal meccas, so, you know, seemed to back them, I guess. Yeah.
I did. A. P. Performance in UC Irvine.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Actually, the UC Irvine Library bought a copy of my book. So,
wow. S.
What do you know?
C. A. Scared. Y. It was scary. Oh, the campus was scary.
Was scary?
Yeah. Well, they have that whole, we were told it was constructed with the riots from UC Berkeley in mind.
Oh,
and
really?
So they set it up so there was no common area. So there wasn't any place that people would congregate.
Would congregate. And
then there were all these underground passages to allow for the police anywhere they needed to go.
Wow.
So that was like the way it was set up.
I've never even been to the campus.
How old is that campus? Less than 30 years?
Yeah, I guess so, if it came after that.
Wow.
It's, you know, it doesn't look too old. A. S. T. A student. Yeah, Frank used to cruise the Sproul Plaza. We used to live closer to UCB. And he'd go out every day in his motor chair and just kind of go people fishing, you know, go up and meet people and talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And one time he met a gal who was up here on break from UC Irvine, and she was going to graduate in, like, you know, after the next semester, and she was so fed up with the place.
Really?
And she said, "Boy, Frank, I'd love to get you down there to do a performance right toward the end of my last semester." And he said, "Great, you know, you set it up, I'll come." So she found a way as a student to get a space, and she did everything herself, and that's how we did it. So it was like through the student that we got in there and did the performance.
Oh, wow, great.
She, they were the very S-T-R straight. Yeah.
Well, this was like in the 80s, and it was, I think for it was that period where, you know, you became aware that everybody was kind of being bought up by a corporation while they were still in school. And so, like, that's like, you know, all of her friends and all the people that came to this performance already, you know, had, they were already being sponsored or hooked up with some corporation for their job when they got out of school. Everybody seemed really straight and really, like, you know, so fragile.
How did your performance go there?
It was a pretty intense thing. well, they we decided what the performance that Frank was going to do was a performance that usually involved us pairing the people in the audience in groups of twos and threes, and I would pull these gestures out of a bag that Frank had compiled, these little strips of paper, and they ranged from, like, you know, hold each other's hands, rub each other's back, to take your clothes off and explore each other's body using all of your body. So it was like, you never knew what you were going to pull out, and some nights you just pull out all these, like, really lightweight things. And
you guys do some interesting performances.
But Frank looked around this room and he said, this is not going to work. So what he did was we put the tables together. It was like a, you know, a large classroom.
Yeah.
And we put the mat on the tables, and Frank got on the table. And did you take your clothes off? I can't even remember. Yeah. And he said to people, when Linda reads a gesture, if you feel comfortable doing that gesture, come up and do it with me. And then you can sit back down until you find another gesture. And so what happened by the end of it, the entire room was on top of Frank. So there's like 30 people, and you see Frank's head kind of like sticking out because they couldn't do anything with each other. It was just too freaky.
Really?
And so they had to kind of have Frank as their focal point. I saw these two guys at one point. It was like rub each other's feet or shoulders or something. And they said afterwards, you know, she had a big, like, spaghetti dinner for everybody afterwards at her house. And
this was the woman that Frank had met at Sprawl Plan.
Yes. Yeah. And they said afterward that, you know, that was, like, such a big deal for them, you know, to rub each other's shoulders like that.
Really?
That it just, like, was this big breakthrough.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, seemed to think it was really great.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
But it is very conservative down there. There's this, you know, it's just very different from the Bay Area.
Why? How? Did you get O U out A L alive?
How did I get out alive? Well, it's, I don't know. I just got in my truck and drove away. I was living in the, there were these three state beaches, state park campgrounds within just kind of a close proximity of each other. And I was sleeping in my vehicle and basically, you know, parking at night in the campgrounds. And, I got a job working at the San Clemente car wash, which is actually my first job when I came out to California. This was in the mid-1980s. And I even got a few gratuities every now and then for doing things like wiping excess drops off of the hood or a bumper of a BMW or a Mercedes or a Volvo. Volvo drivers, by the way, are the best tippers. Mercedes.
We're a Volvo driver, but it's real old. Does that count? It's an old Volvo.
Mercedes drivers rarely tipped at all.
Yes. I. P. A. Panhandled. Frank panhandled for years in San Francisco.
Yeah, I've done that.
The rich people never give money.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was out panhandling one day, and a homeless guy came by and gave me a dollar.
Right. That's what Frank always said. P, poor people give a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that a horrible fact of life?
Yeah.
It is.
It's intense.
Rich people can't can't relate to that situation. They think that you brought it upon yourself.
Right. He said, people, isn't that a horrible fact of life, that rich people can't relate to that situation. They think that you brought it upon yourself. No. They are A, C, T, actually, R, A, F, afraid, of, L, R, L, O, O, losing, there, everything, S, so, they are stingy. They hold on to it because they're afraid they're going to lose everything.
Yeah, hold on to, you know, every last penny they got. But, you know, I think they're also afraid of the homeless people themselves, the panhandlers.
Yeah,
so
they might catch it.
You know, I have this thing where what I do is I adopt a homeless person, and that homeless person becomes my homeless person, and every time I see him, he stands up in front of the Walgreens store near where I live, and every time I see him, I give him some money. But I mean, you can't, you know, obviously you can't give money to everybody, so that's what I do, is I just adopt one guy and sort of take responsibility for him. And anyway, I was standing in line at Walgreens, and this, you know, kind of upper middle class white guy comes in, you know, kind of, you know, very upper, you know, class looking. And I was standing in line behind him at the checkout counter, and he complained to the clerk about my homeless guy standing out in front of the store. And I said, well, why don't you just leave him alone? I mean, he guy's been out there for years. He never hurts anybody. And he got really upset with me and said, well, you know, why don't you go out and give him all your money or something? I don't know. He just turned around and kind of in a huff and walked out the door. But I think that, you know, there's a fear factor involved. Yeah.
A. S. As. If. He. O. W. Owns. The. S.
As if he owns a sidewalk.
Sidewalk.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's, you know, kind of the attitude, you know, that he seemed to take.
Another thing with that is, you know, the rich people, to acknowledge the homeless people eventually will force you to confront them, to confront why they're homeless, you know. And the way the rich people stay rich in one way is by ignoring all the factors that have caused that to happen. So it just stands to reason that with the system in place for how they get that way in the first place, they don't want to have to confront why things are the way they are. So one way is to avoid it at every turn. How are you going to give money to homeless people and not think about why they're homeless, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But whereas the people that are more poor, they can relate to it, and they understand it, and that's why they have the compassion for it.
You know, that was actually a big reason, you know, why we got San Francisco Liberation Radio started was, you know, when I first came to San Francisco, I was still living in my truck with my dog, and I was doing volunteer work with Food Not Bombs. I guess, you know, probably your viewers are pretty much aware of, you know,
Food Not Bombs.
Yes. Group of activists, and they take food and cook it up and take it down to places like UN Plaza in San Francisco and serve it out to people who are in need. And of course, it's very, very important to Food Not Bombs to serve this food in very high visibility locations so as to call as much attention to the issue of poverty and homelessness, which of course, you know, all too often gets swept under the rug in this country. But
S O so they M A made S, so they made, S, E, R, serving, food illegal?
A crime. Yeah. Yeah. There were more than a thousand arrests of Food Not Bombs members between 1988 and 1996. And that's what kind of compelled us to put the radio station on the air. And I've documented a lot of that history in my book, Rising Up. And it documented for the very reason that, had a lot to do with, why, how and why we got the radio station started.
In the SEV in the 70s, in SA Santa Fe, we G gave to F free meals a day.
Two free meals a day.
To home, to whoever wanted them.
Yeah, that's hard work. Getting two meals a day. Food Not Bombs used to do two meals a day in San Francisco. And they would always arrest us. It seemed like most of the time they would arrest us at the lunch meal, because that was the meal in which, business people and tourists were about. And they didn't seem to bother us too much during the evening meal, but it was the lunch meal that they were really trying to stop, because that was getting the most attention.
What was that? What was their L.O.? Their logic?
Well, they carried out these arrests. They justified them and sort of explained them away by saying that Food Not Bombs was just kind of stubbornly refusing to get a health department permit. But the reality was that Food Not Bombs members spent many, many, many hours negotiating with city officials over this whole issue of permits. Only to have the city repeatedly change the requirements from one day to the next, and to just, pretty much deal in a just kind of a general all-around bad faith manner with the group. But they claimed it was for health reasons that they were doing it.
Did any one get sick?
No.
From the food?
and something like 100,000 meals served, no one ever got sick.
Wasn't there some high-profile person that ate the food and vouched for it? I seem to remember.
Oh, yeah, there was Mike Sugarman at KCBS.
Mike Sugarman at KCBS. He ate the food.
Yeah, he came by and sampled some of the food and took it back to KCBS. And gave some to Narcy David, the food
That's
critic.
Great. Yeah, yeah.
And Narcy David, sampled it and said, this is pretty good.
Food. F from the B E best P L places. Oh, is this from the Santa Fe days? This you would get the food from the best places that you would serve.
Like organic food.
Like organic food. That was probably before people were talking about organic food in the 70s.
Yeah, we got some pretty good food. It was mostly organic. We would get it from the the co-op grocery stores, and there was a vegetable warehouse in San Francisco called Veritable Vegetables, and we would I remember one day they gave us like about 10 wooden crates full of asparagus. Man, it was great.
I have a question about that.
Sure.
Did you ever run into a dilemma with I mean, there's cheaper places to get food than co-ops. So it, was it a question of getting the best quality food? Or you could have gone to a place like Safeway that you might not appreciate, but you'd
Safeway
be feeding more people.
Safeway never would give us any food that I'm aware of. Now, I don't...
Not surprising.
But the alternative food stores were very willing to give us food, and it was food they couldn't sell anymore because it, the apples would have spots on them or something like that, and people wouldn't buy them. So they just gave them the Food Nut Bombs. And it was really good food and organic too.
They T H R O throw it away.
Yeah, I mean, if they didn't give it to us, they'd just throw it away. It'd go in the dumpster. Sure.
W H I which M makes you wonder how no why there is H U hunger in the first place with all that food getting thrown away.
Well, I mean, it's frightening the amount of food that gets thrown away in this country. I mean, I worked at a restaurant. I mean, I've worked at several restaurants, and, we would just throw away.
At the end of the night.
At the end of the night. Right.
Me too.
100 pounds of food or more. So, if the resources can just get, spread around, it would, go a long way towards solving the hunger problem.
It is A, B, about D, I, S, distribution.
Yeah, that's a lot of it. I mean, Food Not Bombs was, I haven't been involved with Food Not Bombs for a number of years now, but I mean, I'm talking about like back in the early 90s. Food Not Bombs was really, doing a public service by, distributing food that otherwise would have just been thrown away. And, there were thousands, I think the latest estimate is 15,000 homeless people in San Francisco right now. And the soup, the other soup kitchens, St. Anthony's Dining Room and Glide Church, they were all turning away people. They would run out of food and just have to turn people away. And even though they were doing that, the police would still come and arrest, Food Not Bombs. And there was one time when they actually confiscated a bucket of soup. And I talk about this in the book. They confiscated a bucket of soup and threw it in the Civic Center fountain right in front of these homeless people who were lined up to get the food. This was during Frank Jordan's years as mayor, and the Civic Center fountain didn't have any water in it at that time. So they just took this big bucket of soup and dumped it in the fountain. So that was, that's the kind of thing that was going on, and that was why we started our radio station. It was kind of like our, secret weapon to fight back against that.
S. So, how did the radio station see O N N connect with Food Not Bombs?
Well, the radio station grew out of my involvement with Food Not Bombs. The three of us who founded the radio station together were all members of Food Not Bombs. And it was pretty much in direct response to all those arrests, those food serving arrests that were going on in San Francisco.
You mean because the only media account of the whole thing was the mainstream media and it made Food Not Bombs look bad?
Well, the mainstream media wasn't the only. I mean, it was getting some publicity on, you know, certainly KPFA. Keith McHenry, one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs, had like a monthly radio show on KPFA, and he, you know, so it was getting out there a little bit in the alternative media, but. You know, one 30-minute show a month is not really enough to make much of a dent in the public consciousness, you might say. So, you know, we felt like it, you know. So then, that we needed, our own radio station, and that became possible in 1992. I met a man who knows a great deal about electronics, Stephen Dunifer. And he and I got to, you know, talking about the possibility of putting a radio station on the air, and that's what we did. Well, actually, we put two stations on the air. He put a station on the air here in Berkeley and named it Free Radio Berkeley. And just a few weeks after Free Radio Berkeley went on the air, I and my three partners over in San Francisco, with Stephen's technical help, we got San Francisco Liberation Radio started.
L. E. Let. Us. B. A. Back. Back up. Why. Did. You. A. H. A homeless guy. Think. You could do a radio station.
I don't know. Pretty cheeky, huh?
It is like a crip thinking he can start a radio station.
Well, you know, I had been just kicked around by so many cops. I mean, that's one thing you have to contend with when you're homeless or living in your vehicle, as I was. You know, you'd stop and try to park somewhere and sleep for the night, and the police would come along in the middle of the night and force you to move on. And sometimes that would happen, you know, two or three times a night. And when I got to San Francisco and ran into Food Not Bombs, it was for the first time I found homeless people who were fighting back. And that was just tremendously empowering for me, because, you know, my provincial experience with, you know, being homeless and associating with other homeless people was that, you know, when the police got onto you, you did nothing. You know, you just kind of very servilely looked at the ground and followed orders, and if they tell you to get out, you got out. But for the first time in my life, I found homeless people banding together and fighting back against this, you know, sort of abuse. So, hey, by then I was ready to join anything. So I joined, and then eventually came the radio station, and I guess the rest is history, as they say.
Why were they different, the homeless people here? Why were they different?
Well, because of Food Not Bombs, because Food Not Bombs had begun to organize, and homeless people were actually joining Food Not Bombs and beginning to cook and serve food themselves, which I think was, you know, probably the biggest nightmare that San Francisco officialdom had, was that homeless people would actually start joining Food Not Bombs. And but that was the case. You know, a number of people did. There was a tent city which Food Not Bombs organized in, I think it was 1989. They set up a soup kitchen in Civic Center Plaza and went 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I talk about this in the book. Food Not Bombs had to go to court during this time, and they circulated some questionnaires among the homeless people living in the tent city, as to you know, what they felt about Food Not Bombs and whether they thought it was a beneficial service or not. And I've got some of the answers. I've got some of the questionnaires which were submitted to the court. My Food Not Bombs lawyer, Dennis Cunningham, had kept them in his files for all these years, and he passed them on to me when I was researching the book. And you know, some of the answers that they gave were just amazing. You know, one guy said, you know, well, my best friend died of AIDS, and I'm all alone now, and Food Not Bombs provides a, you know, tremendous service. You know, so it was just, you know, really kind of heartbreaking responses like that.
The B L A Black P A Black Panthers S A say it was their school,
their food program. Yeah,
that was the biggest threat.
Yeah,
to the government.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I mean, I kind of draw that parallel in the book. Is, you know, the food, the breakfast program that the Panthers, you know, did, and then Food Not Bombs. What Food Not Bombs does is very similar.
It is very telling. That's very telling.
Yeah. I think it's very threatening to the government for people to be independent and self-sufficient. I think in a strange way, even though, you know, the Republicans, you know, say that they, you know, want people off welfare and all this, mm-hmm. but I think they, you know, really want people to be dependent on the government. And when poor people start organizing and, you know, doing their own food service operation and putting their own radio stations on the air and things like that, I think it really freaks the government out. They don't know how to deal with it.
People might not mind depending on the government a little more if the government was providing them with anything that they needed.
People might not mind depending on the government a little more if the government was providing them more with what they needed.
Yeah, but that's just it. The government doesn't provide people with what they need.
But they, that is always D. A, dangerous. B, because then the government, C, O, controls you.
Yeah. If the government controls the food distribution, then they control you. And so... Yeah, I mean, in a sense, we were sort of breaking their control on us. And but, I mean, you have to keep, you know, in mind, this was, Food Not Bombs started up in 88. This was during the Reagan years. This was at a time when when the U.S. was waging a war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, a government which... very much did provide social services for their citizens. So here they were, you know, trying to topple the Sandinistas, and here they were arresting us for serving food. And it's kind of almost like in the strange way the U.S. government was trying to stop people from eating. but you know, in a weird way, you know, it was kind of like that.
Or T are trying to keep them victims, or trying to keep people victims.
Well, I think just basically trying to keep people, you know, homeless people out of sight and out of mind. I remember one particular telling incident was when Food Not Bombs first started up serving food at Haight and Stanion Street. The government tried to offer them a deal. If you'll shut down your Haight and Stanion operation, we'll let you serve food at Page and Stanion, which is a much less visible, you know, busy location than Haight and Stanion.
I can't believe they even had the nerve to say that.
Well, they did, and you know, which gave the lie to their claim that all along it was about health reasons. Right. I mean, if it was about health reasons, right, they shouldn't have wanted, you know, serving anywhere, you know, right, Page and Stanion or anywhere else.
So, how? Easy was it to start the radio station up?
Well, it was pretty hard. There was a lot of trial and error. We started out with a little tiny transmitter that I think was about 5 watts. And we didn't know what we were doing in those days. Our first antenna was a Yagi antenna. That's spelled Y-A-G-I, and I think it's named after its inventor. But we had built ourselves a Yagi antenna, and Stephen didn't help us with the antenna. Keith and I had built it on our own. And nobody had told us, you know, Stephen never mentioned, or nobody had told us that you're supposed to mount a Yagi, you know, horizontally, like a TV antenna. And we didn't know that, so we had mounted it vertically on Keith's roof. I mean, we were a couple of rank amateurs back in those days. And so a Yagi antenna is a directional antenna. You can point it in whatever direction you want it to send the signal in. Well, by mounting it vertically, we had the signal pointed directly down into the roof of the house. And so, but that was our first broadcast, and, you know, like I say, we weren't too swift in those days, but we got everything going. We got the transmitter.
How did you find out that it was pointed the wrong way? No, how did you find, is that it? How did you find out it was pointed? No one could hear you? How did you find out that no one could get you?
Well, that's what happened. After we got the transmitter hooked up, and we stuck a tape on or something, and decided to go out in the street and walk up the street and see how far our signal was carrying. And we took a little boombox with us, and we thought maybe we were reaching out maybe a mile, maybe 2 miles or something like that. We got half a block up the street to the donut shop at the end of the block, and it faded out completely. So we had a lot of, you know, trial and error stuff.
Did
like
you know
that.
From that you had the antenna mounted wrong? Or
we didn't know we had the antenna mounted wrong, I think, until... I'm not sure exactly when I learned that you're supposed to mount a Yagi horizontally, but I didn't know it that night anyway, so...
How long was it pointed down?
Oh, we were on the air for like an hour or so, and it was pointed down the whole time. And we got up to the street and found out the signal was fading. It wasn't even, you know, going past the end of the block. We, you know, got kind of discouraged and went back in, you know, and turned the transmitter off.
You were Al lucky. You were lucky that you're only on an hour when you figured it out.
Yeah.
Rather than like a week.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't going anywhere, so there wasn't any reason to stay on the air, so we just turned it off. That was our first broadcast, and in a way, it was kind of an experimental, you know, operation that night, and we were still, you know, getting our feet wet. But that was May 1st, 1993. Coincidentally, that same summer saw the city of San Francisco launch its now infamous Matrix program, in which they began these arrest procedure and stuff against homeless people, and we did get the radio station going pretty strong by that summer, enough that we were able to speak out against what was going on there. The Matrix program, for those who may not be familiar with it, was essentially a program of class cleansing. It was the brainchild of police chief turned mayor, Frank Jordan. And ostensibly, it only involved the confiscation of homeless people's property. It only involved the ticketing of homeless people for, so-called nuisance crimes, and, sleeping on the sidewalk or urinating in public or what have you. But, the reality was that it entailed extensive and often punitive confiscation of homeless people's property. And I'm proud to say that we were able to get on the air, that summer, really get our signal going strong and speak out very, vociferously against that practice.
I seem to remember from your book something about, you can tell me if this was in the Matrix program or somewhere else.
She talked about it.
I'm sorry. I seem to remember from the book something about you couldn't be laying down under a blanket. Is that correct? Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, well, that was actually before the Matrix program. They were enforcing some law called 647I. And I'm not sure if that was a state law or a local law, but I just remember everybody called it 647I. And if you were under a blanket, that was considered intent to lodge. And you could be arrested for that.
Unless you were sitting upright. Wasn't it okay to be sitting up?
If you were sitting up with no blanket over you, you were legal. But the minute you laid down and covered yourself up with a blanket, you were in violation of 647I.
So you basically had to sit up and pretend you weren't sleeping.
Yeah.
If you wanted to get any sleep.
Right, right. And I actually remember one night, this is during the Gulf War, we did an all-night Food Not Bombs set up in Civic Center and went round the clock. During the Gulf War, we were camped out right next to the Vietnam veterans who were also opposing the war. And our little vigil there kind of became a magnet for the homeless people in the area who, felt a certain amount of safety being camped out sort of between us and the Vietnam veterans. And so that was the night I learned I learned what the term 5-0 means. Because all night long the police would drive by and somebody would yell 5-0 and everybody would take their blankets off and pretend to be sitting up. And 5-0 means the police, in the parlance of that time. Or it can mean the police are coming, or it can just mean the police. But anyway, somebody would yell 5-0, and everybody would shrug their blankets off and pretend to be, sitting up and having a conversation.
I-N-H. Inhuman. It's inhuman.
Inhuman. Yeah, I agree with you, Frank.
K, J, U, just, H, A, S, hassling.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, you know, what it is, but they seem to want to make people's lives on the street as miserable as possible. Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of needless stuff like that. I mean, like the confiscation of people's property. I mean, we started hearing about these illegal property confiscations as early as June, even though the Matrix program didn't officially get started until August. We start hearing about, you know, people losing their property as early as June. However, it wasn't until November 13th that the corporate media picked up on the story and reported it. They reported it in a very minor way, but, you know, they did report it. It was a story in the Chronicle on page A17 that day, in which the Chronicle reported that the city had begun confiscating homeless people's shopping carts. And furthermore, these cart confiscations, they said, had been ongoing for about the past month. Well, city officials who were quoted in the story professed to be shocked and chagrined that this was going on. And it was all rather feebly explained away as having occurred merely because of, you know, one or two overzealous police officers who had been acting on their own. An explanation which, you know, was pretty much accepted at face value by the Chronicle, even though this, what I refer to in the book as Operation Shopping Cart, even though this was a pretty extensive undertaking involving interdepartmental cooperation between not only the, you know, the police department, but also the city public works department. And they would, you know, they would bring, the public works department would bring in the garbage trucks, and they would just throw people's stuff in the garbage trucks.
H E Hey, it is not a G against the H O homeless home. It is not against the homeless, but S H O shopping carts are D A dangerous.
Shopping carts are dangerous. Yeah, you never know when somebody might speed or run through an intersection on their shopping cart. But, I mean, you know, they were saying that the shopping carts were stolen, so that, you know, they had to round them up and give them back to the supermarkets and that sort of thing. But, you know, it's interesting. Now you see homeless people roaming around the streets of San Francisco pushing little two-wheel carts. Because they've basically, I guess they've made it illegal for homeless people to push shopping carts now, even though, you know, every now and then you see, you know, somebody pushing one.
I and they T-R-A traded in B E N C benches for the P O pop up seats.
Yeah. They've put these little, kind of like pop up seats, so people can't sleep on benches now or lay down on them. Yeah, that's another thing they've done. You're absolutely right. Getting back to that Chronicle story, the reporters who wrote that story, to their immense credit, did manage to get a couple of paragraphs into this page A17 story of theirs in the Chronicle regarding the rather sorry consequences that these car confiscations had had for one homeless man in particular. And I talk about this in the book, quoted from the article. A young man by the name of Kendall Griffiths, age 25, was said to have lost photographs, blankets, a new sleeping bag, all his freshly laundered clothes, and a radio when they seized his shopping cart one day near Civic Center Plaza. So this, you know, this is the kind of thing that was going on, and this was actually reported in the Chronicle, even though, like I say, it was only a minor, you know, reported in a minor way, but it was enough to kind of make the city back off a little bit.
One of my F.A. favorite A.R.T. artists was H.E. Henry. Yeah, he was a homeless guy in Berkeley for years when we lived closer to downtown Berkeley. Frank and I spent a lot of time walking around, so we got to know people. And Henry was this incredible guy. He was a short black guy, real old. Was he like in his 70s? And his, you know, he had a family that lived in Berkeley. You know, he just like, this is like the way he liked to live. But we met him because he used to have like several carts strung together, and he would create these like art installations using like, you know, collage stuff. And we started bringing him stuff, you know, and he would just like these incredible things, and he'd wheel them all around Berkeley. And yeah.
So whatever happened to him?
We just stopped seeing him. We saw him for years.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, there's homeless people out there with some amazing talents. You know, I was in Civic Center Plaza one day, and this homeless guy started playing a guitar. And he was amazing. He was a really talented guy. And he was telling me he had played in a heavy metal band at one time, but, you know, I guess, you know, a long time before he became homeless. And but he was just really talented guitar player. And then the Street Sheet in San Francisco, they, you know, every now and then print a section on homeless poets and print some of their poetry. And so, you know, it's
they
some of it's amazing stuff.
Have a W E website. That's the that newspaper. It's not the Street Sheet. It's something
well, it's
else.
The Homeless Coalition.
Yes. It's a newspaper?
Yeah, well, they publish a newspaper, but the organization is called the San Francisco Homeless Coalition. And, yeah, they do a lot of good work, and they do publish a very good newspaper, actually. And it's, you know, includes poetry, includes news about, you know, the latest police sweeps of, you know, homeless people and latest repressive actions of the mayor and so forth.
I used some of that of their stories for our news program.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's another one here in the East Bay called the Street Spirit.
That's the one. That's the one. The Street Spirit is
well,
the one.
Well, that's run by the American Friends Service Committee. But, it, you know, it's very the newspaper they put out is very similar to the Street Sheet.
Yes. But the R.A., the radio, E.X.P., expanded.
Oh, yeah. Well, we started out just, you know, one or two nights a week broadcasting from the hills, you know, places like Twin Peaks or Mount Davidson or Marin Headlands, places like that. We'd go out and we would set up our transmitter and our antenna and go on the air, usually for, you know, 2 hours or so. The transmitter that we were using in those days was it would run off of a 12-volt DC current, which meant that basically you could power it off of a car battery. So, yeah, we would take our transmitter and, you know, set up the antenna and turn on the transmitter and go on the air and talk about, you know, whatever, you know, the latest arrests, the Food Not Bombs, or you know, the Matrix program, who was being taken to jail, who had been taken to jail and beaten up that day. There was one woman, a woman member of Food Not Bombs, who was arrested at a lunch serving one afternoon, who was taken to lock up and denied access to a bathroom. This went on for like, you know, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours or something like that, until she was just finally more or less just obliged to pull down her pants and pee into a drain in the floor while these male police officers stood and watched. So we had her and her friend, you know, come over to our place, and we taped an interview with them about that, you know, rather horrid experience. And this was the kind of material which we, you know, we would gather and collect throughout the week and put on the air on the nights in which we did our broadcasts. And but we, you know, we gradually expanded from that to, you know, from one or two nights a week to all 7 nights of the week. That happened in 1994. We decided that, you know, it was great being on the air for 2 hours or 4 hours a week, but, you know, we wanted to, you know, make it a, you know, 7-day-a-week operation. So we took the radio station in from the great outdoors and moved it into our apartment and set up the antenna on the roof of the building.
Why did not you do that in the first place?
Well, we were afraid. We were afraid that the government would come to our house and raid us, and in the process, you know, confiscate our belongings.
They can take whatever they want.
Yeah, basically, they can take anything they want. They raided a radio station in Tampa, Florida.
I remember that
and
one.
Took the guy's little station called the Party Pirate, and they took his, you know, they not only took his broadcasting equipment, but they even confiscated his pictures off the wall. They took a picture of Jesus that he had hanging on the wall and took that. So we, you know, we were afraid that, you know, our place would get raided and that we would lose our personal stuff. So that's why we did it, you know, from remote locations for about the first year that we were on the air. But then at one point during that year, I got tracked down by the Federal Communications Commission. I was doing a broadcast. This was on the night of September 22nd, 1993. And I was doing a broadcast on Potrero Hill that night, and I guess, you know, it was about an hour and 10 minutes into the broadcast. It was about 10 minutes after nine when all of a sudden up behind me comes this car with its headlights on, extremely bright. And at first, you know, I didn't think too much about it. At first, I just thought, you know, it's somebody parking, and. So I, you know, I didn't do anything. I just continued with the broadcast. And by the way, I was out by myself that night. Normally, my girlfriend and I would go out and do these broadcasts together, and, you know, occasionally with, you know, one or two other people. But Joe, that was my girlfriend. She had had to, you know, like get up at something like 5 o'clock in the morning the next morning. So we talked it over and decided I'd just, you know, go out and do the broadcast myself that night. So, you know, it was about 10 after 9, this car comes up with its, you know, headlights on, extremely bright, and I didn't think anything about it at first, but, after a while I started getting nervous, because he just kind of sat there with his headlights on bright, and they were blazing through the back curtains of my vehicle. I have this little, you know, motorhome with, you know, we were just using it kind of as a mobile broadcast unit at that time, and it has a little thing on top where you can just pop the antenna up through the roof, and it was, you know, it was pretty neat. And but anyway, I started getting kind of nervous because he just sat there, and finally I started, you know, my imagination was, you know, kind of in overdrive. I didn't know who that was back there. So I took the radio station off the air, unhooked the alligator clips from the battery, and I decided, well, I'm just going to go out and confront who is out there, whoever that is back there, and see what the heck they want and what they're doing back there. So I went to the back door of the camper and preparing to step out on the sidewalk and sort of face down whoever was back there. And I didn't even have to go any further than the back door. This guy was standing right there at the back door, dressed appropriately enough in black. Mm-hmm. And he pulls out a little ID and says, FCC. And, you know, at first he said, well, do you have a license to broadcast at 93.7? And I said, no. And,
do you need? Do you need one? do you need one?
we don't need no stinking license. they claimed we needed one, but we never agreed with that.
What did they know?
But anyway, I mean, he asked me for permission to come inside the camper and inspect the equipment, which I denied him. And basically, my idea was just to refuse to cooperate with him in any way. And he said, well, okay, you know, if you're not going to cooperate, I'm going to have to call the police. And so I basically said, well, okay, you've got your job to do and I've got mine. And so he went back to his car, and on the other hand, I didn't feel like I was obligated to sit there and wait for the police to arrive, so I climbed up to the roof, took down the antenna, threw everything in the back of the truck, got in the driver's seat, started up the engine, and drove away.
See?
He didn't try to block you or anything?
Well, he followed me. He we came down off of Potrero Hill and got on the 101 freeway, and he was behind me the whole, and I thought, oh my God, here I am in this big huge motor home, and here he is in this passenger car. I'll never lose him. But in fact, that's what happened. We got off the freeway in Civic Center, and it must have been opera night or symphony or night or something. There was just huge traffic jam in Civic Center. And all these people walking around the streets dressed in formal evening wear. And so I'm sort of navigating my way through this traffic jam with the FCC guy on my tail. And I was able to get over a lane and then another lane. And then finally I turned up this side street and he wasn't able to get over there to turn up behind me. But I didn't get very far. The police pulled me over on Webster Street, and he probably had a cell phone or something in his car and had, you know, phoned in my license plate number and description of my vehicle and so forth. So they pulled me over, and they were just like pumped to the gills with adrenaline because all they had been told apparently was that I was fleeing from a federal agent. I mean, they didn't know apparently hadn't been given the nature of the offense or anything. So they, you know, they thought they had the Unabomber, I guess, or something. And, they started yelling, get out of the truck, get out of the truck, get your hands up in the air. And, you know, so finally, you know, they got me, you know, handcuffed with my hands, you know, cuffed behind me. And then they all just kind of stood there and looked at each other and said, well, who is this guy and why do we have him here? And then about 5 minutes later, the guy from the FCC arrived on the scene. He finally made his way out of that traffic jam in Civic Center. He finally got over there to Webster Street, and introduced himself to the cops and told them he was from the FCC and that I had been broadcasting without a license. And the police sort of looked at each other. And at that point...
Embarrassing?
It was kind of embarrassing for the FCC guy, I think. And the police, I felt a definite shift in their sympathies.
They probably thought you were a murderer or something.
And they ended up letting me go. But they allowed the FCC guy to look at my driver's license, and he was able to take down the information on my driver's license, my address, and everything. But they let me go after that, and they didn't even confiscate the broadcast equipment in the truck. They just left it in there. So I drove away with the transmitter, the antenna, and everything. But about 6 weeks later, I got a notice in the mail saying... notice of apparent liability, it's called, from the FCC, informing me that I was being fined $10,000 for broadcasting without a license. So that all happened in September of
93. Do you have one? $10,000?
No, I don't have $10,000. I would have been more worried if they had fined me $50 or something like that. I mean, that's theoretically an amount I could have paid, but they made it just such a ridiculous amount.
And, like, will you ever have $10,000?
I don't know, maybe sometime.
If you do, will
I sell enough books?
That's another question.
You get enough donations in San Francisco Liberation Radio. But that was in September of 93. And after that happened, we started thinking, well, now that the FCC knows who we are and they know where we live and they have our address, what are we doing driving up to Twin Peaks or places like that to do the broadcast?
Freedom.
Freedom. Yeah, in a way, it was freedom. It was kind of a relief in a way. We didn't have to cover our trail so much. We made the decision to bring the radio station in and set it up in our apartment with the... antenna, kind of mounted permanently up there, sort of like a 1,000-year-old redwood. But this was, it was still kind of a risky thing for us to do because it meant that now we were completely out in the open with this, 30-foot antenna mounted on our roof, just kind of sticking up in the air like a sore thumb for anybody who cared to take note of our activities.
On the other hand, though, you had access to the same group of people all the time.
It
might have been people that got you in the Potrero Mission area, and they tune in next time, and you're broadcasting from the Marin Headlands.
Exactly.
At least this way, people could know to keep tuning in again and again because it was always broadcasting in the same area.
Yeah.
That probably helped establish the idea.
That helped, having a steady 7-night-a-week operation, plus broadcasting to the same people. But the downside of it was our house is at a lower elevation from... some of the places we were broadcasting at, like particularly Twin Peaks. When we were broadcasting from Twin Peaks, you could hear us over here in Berkeley.
Really?
But after we moved, after we came down from Twin Peaks and started broadcasting from our house, our signal area shrunk quite a bit. So there were pros and cons. There were good
that
things to be gained. And
is why... we need MO, more radio, micro powered radio stations.
Yeah, we definitely do. And we would have had more had the FCC been able to pass their low power FM initiative. you know, the FCC back in the early 90s was very different from the FCC in the late 90s. I think it was around 96 or 97 that a new FCC chairman took over. His name was William Kennard. He was the first African-American to ever head the FCC. And he saw the tremendous need to sort of bring about greater diversity on the airwaves after, you know, the passage of the telecom bill of 1996. Now, that was resulted in tremendous consolidation.
What was that?
It was a bill that was passed by Congress in February of 1996, and it resulted in just an unprecedented consolidation of ownership of radio stations in America. Prior to the passage of that bill, in 1995, the top 50 radio station chains owned a cumulative total of 852 stations nationwide. Today, one corporation alone, Clear Channel Communications, owns more than 1,100 radio stations. So that's been the kind of consolidation of ownership that has come about as a result of the telecom bill.
You did A B I T a bit at the benefit where you W E went T through the D I A the dial.
Oh, yeah. I talked about our neighbors on the FM dial in San Francisco. Yeah, we have some really illustrious neighbors on the FM dial in San Francisco. We broadcast at 93.7. Now, if you go up the dial just a little bit from there, you come to KYLD at 94.9, which is owned by Clear Channel Communications. And KYLD is some of their DJs have committed some sort of, you know, they have a habit of staging these sort of moronic, shameless little stunts to boost ratings. There was late last year, two of their DJs, Joseph Lopez and Graham Herbert, were charged by San Mateo County authorities with misdemeanors for pretending to be escaped jail inmates. They were arrested while roaming through a residential neighborhood dressed in orange jail jumpsuits and wearing handcuffs, sort of greatly alarming local residents. Then there was a woman who sued the station in 1999, alleging that KYLD DJs made a phone call to her home, and while impersonating a doctor by the name of Dr. Curley, accused her of child abuse. And then there were the parents of a Santa Clara County teenage girl who alleged that KYLD DJs in 1997, this was actually before Clear Channel took over the station, had solicited their daughter to strip naked and to cover her body with the station's bumper stickers. But
H E, hey, F, R, E, free speech. Hey, free speech.
Hey, free speech. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the trouble. They don't have free speech on that station. You know, you can't hear anybody talking about the war in Afghanistan other than saying, you know, let's go bomb them. KYLD actually isn't the only Clear Channel station that has engaged in these sort of stunts. There was a
Clear Channel stations are there in San Francisco?
I'm not sure exactly how many. I know they've got KYLD and they've got KMEL, and I'm sure they've got some others as well. I'm just not sure which ones they have. But they've got a station called KBPI in Denver, and so the DJs there got into trouble for urging listeners to take four-wheel drive trucks into a fragile wetlands area for a so-called mud fest. Sheriff's officials estimated that some 200 vehicles chewed up several acres of vegetation. And there was a Clear Channel station in Florida where a DJ by the name of Bubba the Love Sponge, the morning DJ, staged a little event called Bubba's Roadkill Barbecue. And what they did was they brought in a live boar that had been captured somewhere and brought it into the parking lot of the station and castrated it and slaughtered it and cooked it. And they made a big thing about saying that the castration had to take place before the boar was slaughtered because they were having a... I guess something like a testicle eating contest to see who could eat the boar's testicles. And supposedly testicles taste better if they've been cut off of a living animal rather than a dead. But anyway, Bubba the Love Sponge and his crew got charged with animal cruelty. Some animal rights organizations, including PETA, made a really big stink about it. And Clear Channel... they left Bubba on the air, but they made this announcement that they weren't going to utilize animals in their ridiculous little stunts anymore.
C-L-E, Clear Channel, A-L, also owns M-O. S most of the concert promoters. They own Bill Graham.
Is that right?
Now.
Yeah. They own Bill Graham, really?
Yes. So they own the radio stations, and they own the concert.
And they own the concert. Boy, they got it locked up now.
There's three more. KISS FM, KFOX, and KYT.
They
Local Clear Channel stations.
Yes.
KFOG and...
KFOX.
KFOX.
KISS FM and KYT.
They own KOIT now?
Yeah.
Really? Because KOIT was owned by Bonneville up until, I guess last year. They must have just recently acquired it.
Yeah,
well, I mean, there you go. I mean, these radio stations, change hands so much, and these mergers, pretty soon it'll be one corporation owning all of them. At the rate it's going, anyway.
KSJO.
They own KSJO, too.
We played, when they came up with that list of all the songs that shouldn't be played, we did a marathon and played every
song. We did too, Deke did it on his show.
Yeah, I did a show that was exclusively banned songs.
Fun, huh?
You know, what was funny was I encouraged my listeners to call in and see if they could guess what the connection was with all the songs, because I didn't say what they were. And a whole lot of people called in that night. You don't have any way of knowing how many people are listening. And
right.
I got about 5 calls that night from excited listeners looking to participate in the game of figuring out what was the connection between all the songs.
It was G H A hard to figure out how some of the songs were connected.
I would have thought so, but after about 3 songs, one guy called in and said he knew, and then later in the show, a bunch of people called in. after a while, I announced it because I wanted people, you know, it wasn't so much for the game as I wanted to be able to explain to people what the theme of the night was and have them hear some songs after that so that while they were hearing the songs, they'd have an impression of how ridiculous it was.
Right.
So I announced about halfway through the show what the theme was. And then people called in later just to say, I can't believe it, because a lot of them didn't know about that. And what it showed me was not just that I have a lot of listeners, or at least some, which was nice, but it also showed me that people were shared the sentiment of how
some
ridiculous
of those songs,
it was.
I mean, I couldn't understand the logic.
Right. Of, that's what happened with us,
why
too.
Why they were banned.
My F-A, my favorite one was you. Up, T, O, town, uptown, B, by, downtown, by Petula Clark, downtown.
Downtown? That was on the banned list? you know, go figure.
Is it because
I can tell
the
you
World
why.
Trade Center
it's
is
why.
Downtown? Is
That's
that
exactly why.
Because the World Trade Center is downtown.
If you think of downtown, you think of New York. So automatically it reminds you of the World Trade Center. As if anybody wasn't thinking about it anyway. You know they banned Imagine by John Lennon.
By John
Lennon. Thought that was really funny.
This is no time for peace songs.
No time, yeah.
Right.
This is, we're all upset. We're angry. We don't want to hear peace songs.
I mean, some of the ones they banned, you know, you could kind of see the connection. They banned Mother, Do You Think They'll Drop the Bomb by Pink Floyd.
They banned
so, you know,
Shot
I mean,
Down
I
in Flames by AC/DC. That one I can understand.
F you. Funny. They. No. Two. W. Weeks later, M, O, most, S, O, most songs, in, B, E, N, oh, and the, all the benefits that have been going on are from that list.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, a lot of them were, yeah.
You know, later they claimed that they had never banned the songs and all that.
Yeah.
But originally
they
it seemed.
The whole thing.
Right. They said it was just a suggestion.
Yeah.
Is there really such a thing as a suggestion coming from, like, your
parent corporation? Yeah, coming from a corporate head office.
Yeah.
Please? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are our illustrious neighbors up the dial at 94.9 now. Then you go down the dial to 88.5 and you come to KQED, which is an affiliate, of course, of NPR. The president and CEO of NPR is a man by the name of Kevin Close, who... was formerly head of the U.S. International Broadcasting Bureau, which oversees, among other things, the Voice of America, which is the official state-run propaganda arm of the U.S. government. From 1994 to up until 1997, Close was also head of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, both of which were run by the CIA up until the 1970s. Now, this is the guy who's running NPR now. It's interesting, when asked to comment about these rather, you know, sinister, you know, State Department propaganda connections of his, longtime NPR pundit Daniel Shore responded, and I quote, "It did not occur to me that that was even a problem," you know. Yeah. Which all of which, you know, given all this, it should come as no surprise.
S E N, senile. Frank thinks he's going senile.
It's probably a little Alzheimer's there or something. But,
T H R. I, U, S, Thrush TV. Oh, they did a thing where they had they pitched their show, Thrush TV. They it was like a group of San Francisco people that show on Berkeley Cable Public Access and San Francisco Public Access, just like, you know, little skits. And they pitched their show to KQED.
Oh, really?
And they made a really funny video of this whole thing. Now, again, I'm going to run dry on the details of it. Do you remember how that played out?
Well, there were two women there.
Representing the
directors,
right.
And basically they just critiqued the thing and just ripped it apart after it was over. I don't know what else.
The KQED.
The KQED people critiqued it. Gee. Good. Good. But you will need have to see H change everything. Right. That was basically it. This is good, but very dead serious. But you're going to have to change.
We'll accept your show, but you have to change it all.
Everything. Yes.
Redo it.
It's they do satire. It will. F offend M O most people. So we have to clean it up.
Mm. But it's great outside
of that. It's great other than that, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, you have to look at NPR's sort of march towards commercialism. I mean, maybe that sounds self-righteous in a way, but...
They are FU funded by CO...
Corporations.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they have to worry about offending their advertisers. And then that's what passes for, public radio. In this country, and I mean, it's interesting, that NPR, as well as along with CNN, were both discovered to have employed PSYOPs officers.
Yes,
from the U.S. Army's 4th Psychological Operations Group.
Yes, and they don't. S, C, anything
wrong
with
it? Yeah. And this was going on. I mean, this was in 1999 when they were dropping bombs and depleted uranium on the people of Yugoslavia. So, anyway, that's NPR. They're our illustrious, upstanding neighbor down the dial at 88.5. Now we need to keep in mind that our neighbors up the dial are members of the NAB, or National Association of Broadcasters, which in turn has joined forces with our neighbors down the dial at NPR in an effort to kill micro radio. And indeed, just last year they teamed up and successfully pressured Congress into passing the so-called Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act.
Why are they... A. F. Afraid of us.
They're afraid. They claim it has to do with interference, that micro stations will cause interference with their stations. Although,
that is S. L. S. M. O. Smoke.
Yeah, that's a smokescreen, exactly. The real reason is they're afraid that micro stations will start, taking advertisers from them, and that they'll start losing advertisers and listeners to micro stations.
But we don't take advertisers.
Well, we don't know. I mean, we don't. We recently started a program wherein we're accepting underwriting from small, locally owned businesses, and they have to be small, and they have to be locally owned. But now other micro stations have wanted to go, you know, the advertising route. And
that is dangerous.
Well, it's dangerous. What do you mean, the underwriting or what?
Advertising. Taking advertising.
It is, yeah. I mean, you can sort of get on the rocky slope there and end up, losing your integrity and your credibility.
I don't even take tell. How many people listen? Frank won't even tell people that number.
You won't tell how many people listen? Why not?
I don't want the DJs to focus on that.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, doing an internet station, you guys can tell how many people are tuning in. We have no way of knowing that.
That is good.
Well, yeah, in a way it's good, although sometimes, you sit there in front of the microphone and you don't know if anybody's listening or not. I mean, it can be late at night and you're sitting there in the studio all by yourself and the phone isn't ringing. You don't know if anybody at all is listening.
What is the MA magic number? To make it worth it?
I don't know. Do you know what the magic number is? I don't know.
Sometimes I don't know if anybody's listening to my show.
Is it one person?
I guess it's long. I mean, even if you just got, 15 listeners, it's still worth it. I think so, yeah.
But the the way I-S-T-A started, Lover. Frank was doing this show on another internet station called Fake Radio. Mm-hmm. And he had met a guy on the internet, and the guy said he was involved in this internet station. This was, 5 years ago or something. And Frank said, I always had a fantasy of doing a show. He said, we could get something going here. He was reading, right. When he met Frank, he was in the process of reading Annie Sprinkle's book. And Annie lists Frank as one of her teachers.
Oh.
So he was just reading about that, and then he meets Frank. So he was, really impressed, And so he was very much into getting Frank involved in the station. They perceive themselves as a free speech station.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was like somebody who, was fighting for free speech. So this was like a very cool thing. And we quickly discovered what they meant by free speech was you can curse. Yeah.
Oh.
But there were things you couldn't say on the air. Yeah. And Frank, being the antennae that he is, found out. Well, for example, it was the DJs were saying, I don't know if anybody's listening to my show. And so why should I do it if nobody's listening? And so Frank said, well, first of all, how do you know that? And I think there are people listening. Second of all, even if there's nobody listening, if people tune in and there's nothing on the air, they're not going to tune back. So there's got to be something going if you want to build a listenership.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if nobody's listening.
Right. Right.
And so that was like not okay for Frank to say that. And so and then during his weekly show, he started talking about that on the air. And we quickly got a private message from the management, you know, which is the guys who started the station. I mean, the management. But that's how they thought of themselves. Saying that you're not allowed to talk about the station's policies on the air. And so what Frank did was he had me read all this out on the air. Okay, now we're getting a private message from the management, and this is what it said.
And you read that over the air?
We're reading all this over the air. And so this went on, and they finally just backed off because, you know, they could see that it wasn't working. Frank wasn't, like, buying the intimidation thing. So then the next thing was they said that they decided that they had to sell out. They had to hook up and get some outside money through advertising to pay the bills. And so Frank said, and they said, you know, we don't really see it as compromise, even though there are certain things we won't be able to do. People never do see it as compromise when they compromise.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a contradictory statement to say we don't see it as compromise, even though there are certain things we won't be able to do.
Frank said, well, how much does it cost to run the station? This was an information they wouldn't pass out. He said, because you have, like, how many DJs? If everybody gives $5 or $10 a month, can we cover the cost?
Yeah.
Well, they weren't interested in that. And
well, that
sounds familiar.
Yeah, that's what we're doing now. We've given our DJs an option of either going out and finding a business to underwrite their program or to just pay the $20 fee themselves. And most people seem to be just paying the $20 fee, although I don't know if that...
That's like $20 a month?
If you get the underwriter, it's $40 for them for a month.
Yeah.
Right. So it would actually help the station financially more to have an underwriter. But, you know, it's a little easier on the DJs if you can pay 20.
Just to pay it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't...
That's new this month.
Yeah, we just started
it.
After 8 years of, you know, trying to support ourselves through T-shirt sales and, you know, benefit concerts.
You know, there's an interesting
thing.
Hey,
look at us, T-shirt sales.
Hey, that's a nice one. I like that. Yeah.
I was eating at a restaurant with... another DJ on the station a couple weeks ago, and there was a guy there with a San Francisco Liberation Radio T-shirt on.
Really?
Yeah, and I was with Sarah, and we both wanted to go talk to the guy and ask him about it, but he was engrossed in a conversation, and then he got up and left and slipped away. We never got to find out who he was.
Mm. Which one was it? Was it the black ones, the white one?
It was black with white writing on it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So
those are some...
He didn't look familiar to either one of us.
F-A...
Fake radio, C, O, cost. It only costs $99 a month to run it.
Yeah,
and they
all?
Were going to sell out for $99.
Well, how many listeners could you have for $99 a month?
That is the POI. That's the point. What is the point? NU numbers are dangerous.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Thing about, you know, internet stations is, though, I mean, aren't you, I mean, you don't they have something like called streams, and you can have only like so many streams at you know, any given time? I don't know. I don't know much about internet radio. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
And No. Yes and
yes
no.
Yes and no. Yeah.
R E A. Really? That don't E effect that don't affect my that don't affect us that don't affect P E people thinking W E well it O only can R reach X amount of people
reach X amount of people
yes mm. It can only reach X amount of people yeah. S O so they don't S T A R they don't start oh that's the way people think they think well why start an internet station because it's limited to reaching X amount of people so why bother starting
because it can't grow past a certain point
right yeah. Yes.
That's why numbers are dangerous.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In reality, one, there are S splitters. A splitter can, it's called a splitter, it can tune into your station and then
rebroadcast
it has
it.
Yeah it yeah. has whatever amount of streams yeah. it has and then somebody can split from that and yeah. so it really is indefinite and you have no way of knowing
yeah.
how many
yeah.
it goes from there
yeah that I mean that's our internet guy was sort of telling me something or I think he, you know something about that we're now on the internet too although that's just been kind of a recent thing for us
It's been working again lately.
Has it?
It has.
Good.
It's good.
It's been kind of off and on. So, but although it seems to be on every time I tune into it. But anyway, yeah, he was saying something about that. You can kind of like multiply the number of listeners that you have.
A. L. Also. If. Also you, if you do J U S just A U D I O, if you do just audio, not video.
Right, then you can pretty much go unlimited. It's really just the capacity of your server that determines, like Shoutcast, and even the Microsoft media thing now that's out, they don't have, limits on how many streams are available.
Oh, really?
Like Real has, they sell you a certain amount.
Yeah.
Shoutcast, I don't think, has any limits on it.
Yeah, so video uses up more bandwidth if you were just going on.
Microsoft is video, too. Windows media stuff is all video. So
there's no limit on that either, then, even if you do video. It's just that when we started, Real was the only thing available that could handle video and audio.
Right, so we wanted to be able to go cross-platform to Macs and Windows, and at the time there was nothing from Windows Media that would serve Macs.
Mm-hmm.
And MP3 stuff is just audio.
Right.
But people are... B R A I brain washed they into thinking in terms of numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true.
L, you, lover, reaches 3 M, I, million people a year that we know of.
Oh, that's pretty impressive. Yeah.
But when I T R try no T E when I tell people that they think, oh, only 3 million? Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot of people.
Right.
3 million people.
That's what we think. Yeah.
Certainly enough to call it worth it.
Yeah.
By any means.
Definitely. Maybe we could be a lot lower and we'd call it worth it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot lower.
Yeah.
Like A W O M, a woman. Oh, that showed up in the chat room. No, a woman. C A came to came to us. Came to us. I don't know. C-U-C-H. R. Oh, Christina. Oh, right. Well, she kind of had like kind of a growth type business, a woman's only thing she was doing, that she had been doing and had kind of a little following. And she didn't know anything about the internet, but, you know, she just knew you had to be on the internet, you know. And so she had actually paid some guy thousands of dollars and she said, you know, she wants, you know, like, she wants like a really great setup, you know, video and audio and stuff. So for the thousands of dollars, what he did was he did this presentation in a book with all these color graphs and charts where he had like her house and up in the, where is she?
San Rafael.
Had all these cameras and, you know, this whole big kind of television setup. You know, not finding out that, first of all, because she was a little bit out in the boondocks, she couldn't get a connection to her house, so she couldn't even handle all that stuff, like little right. details like that. But she, meanwhile,
it was $500,000 setup.
$500,000 setup
wow.
he designed for her. And so she, what, when I told her about... Frank said, you know, we're doing everything that you want to do, and it costs us $200 a month, you know, and mm-hmm. you don't need any of that stuff. We have one camera. We have, you know, a CD player. You can, you may, you will not get T-H-O thousands of people. Because she had these pictures that she was going to reach thousands of people worldwide.
Yeah.
Said, you're not going to reach thousands of people. You're not going to... She thought she's going to make a lot of money selling her stuff. You're not going to make any money. And you can do this and spend very little money. She's not interested in that. She doesn't want to do that. She wants to just do this big thing.
She doesn't want to do it and spend very little money. She wants to do it and spend a lot of money.
She wants to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
She can spend a little and make none.
She didn't... Well, she's even... R A D radio I radical G R groups. You have the same thing where where they we hear that a radical group that, like, maybe we've played their videotape or something, and then somebody tells us that they want to do something on the internet, like what we're doing. And so we say, we'll tell them everything. We'll tell them exactly what to do. We'll give them the places to go. They can do it for a couple hundred dollars. Don't want to do it. They want to spend thousands of dollars. It's, you know, it's like, I guess the thinking is, if you're not spending a lot of money, you're not doing it right.
You're not, yeah.
B.
That's a shame.
R. Yeah. A. Brainwashed, as our friend calls
brainwashed. Yeah. Well, that's a lot of brainwashing in America these days.
Yeah.
Especially since September 11th.
That. K. Keeps. M. O. Most people from getting, from doing, M, E, media.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of people are doing, you know, some, well, I wouldn't say a lot, but, you know, people are doing micro radio stations, like, out of their, you know, there's a car dealership that does its own micro station, and which is, you know, not what the movement was all about to begin with, but there's one guy had the idea he was going to put a micro radio station in a shopping mall and play kind of like easy listening music and commercials for the different businesses in the mall. And and then, of course, after the FCC passed their low-power FM initiative, there was like this gold rush, you know, of people wanting to open up, you know, micro stations to, you know, to do, you know, Christian radio stations. And, in fact, I think over half of the people who applied for licenses were, you know, planning on doing some kind of religious, you know, programming.
B. R, BR, the, P, E, the people, like, you, who, are, doing, it, N, O, now, could, not, get started now. What? Is that it? Could not get the, P, E, R, permits. The people like you
could
who
you
have
now?
Been doing it cannot get permits through this new licensing
no,
thing?
No, because the Congress overturned the FCC's new licensing scheme. But even if they hadn't done that, people like myself would have been unable to get a license anyway, because we're considered you know, FCC violators. And they weren't going to grant any amnesty to people who had violated FCC regulations in the past.
What kind of message would that send, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, which is ridiculous, because they've done that for full power, you know, broadcasters in the past, but they wouldn't do it for micro broadcasters. So basically, yeah, after the passage of this bill, what it kind of boils down to is there will be no micro stations licensed to operate in cities, virtually none. Under the, you know, the new bill that they passed, it'll be pretty much a rural phenomenon.
Because of dial availability.
Yeah, because of frequency availability or unavailability.
S. So, what, how will they, that, e, affect.
Affect us.
You.
Well, we're just going to stay. It's not going to affect us at all until they, you know, we're just going to, our plan is to just stay on the air until when and if the day comes, which, the, you know, that they come and shut us down.
Why? Why am I not surprised?
Yeah, we're, you know, we're a pretty determined bunch. That's true. Yeah. You have to be determined, I guess, to keep doing this after 8 years. But, I mean, if we go off the air, you know, that's a victory for the corporations.
Yes.
So we stay on.
How many P R E?
How many people involved in the station?
Yes.
We have about 40 some odd DJs who come in, you know, at various times. It's during the week and do program. Most of our programs are weekly. And we have, yeah, about 40. And it's some of the programs have, like, multiple DJs, and then they bring their friends, and the place gets to be kind of like Grand Central Station on some days. It can be pretty hectic.
N-I-N-O, now, that is A-N-U, a number, I...
It's a number you agree with.
To, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And how many V O I voices we have that are not being heard, and how many voices we have that are not being heard is a number that you're interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and unfortunately, it's probably a pretty high number.
Yes.
Even with stations like ours around and, you know, stations like yours, they're still, you know, one thing I've noticed, you know, since doing San Francisco Liberation Radio is there's a tremendous demand for people to, you know, to have some kind of outlet where they can be heard. We have a waiting list of DJ and people wanting to DJ programs on our station.
I didn't know that.
Oh, God. Well, especially lately, it's really been growing. And, you know, I don't know why so much lately. Maybe, you know.
They could, should
ask you all?
S-T-A, start their own stations?
Well, they could start their own stations, but one thing that kind of prevents that is the... the FM dial is pretty crowded right now, and so, you know, especially here in the Bay Area and other large cities like this. So there, I mean, the corporations are right in one respect. There is a finite number of stations that can go on the air and broadcast over the airwaves. I mean, internet is different. Internet is, you know, is unlimited. As many stations as want to can get on the air, but it's,
how about D I G I digital?
Well, digital, yeah. You know, that's the new thing now, and radio stations are gradually going to be going digital. there was some concern about how the, you know, new digital age of broadcasting would affect micro radio, because under the digital plan, the FM stations are going to adopt this program called IBOC, or in-band on channel, which means that they'll be broadcasting their analog signals and their digital signals over the same frequency, which is going to make the FM band even more crowded than it is currently, which there was some fear that that would squeeze out micro radio.
Who is the P.I. pirate? Who is the pirate?
You want to know who the real pirates are? Well, we think the real pirates are the corporations who have, you know, hijacked the airwaves for their own personal profit. And, you know, I mean, our, you know,
you
position
can't
is... Oh, yeah, that's probably
that
a banned word since September 11th.
Hijacked is a banned word, he said. Can't say that anymore.
But I would like to see, you know, the airwaves given back to the people who own them, which is us, you know, the people. But right now we're just trying to get our foot in the door. But I mean, I think there's a system they have in Europe. The digital system that they've gone to in Europe and in Canada as well is they don't use IBOC there. They use a different system called Eureka 147. And under that system, the FM stations will be moving up to a higher point in the spectrum called the L band, which means they'll be vacating the FM band. And sort of opening that up to small community-run radio stations. So that's the system that they've gone to in Europe, but they won't do that in this country because the Pentagon controls the L-band.
The Pentagon controls the L-band in this country, so they won't do that. What? For? What for? Why does the Pentagon control it?
Supposedly, it's for aircraft testing, testing experimental aircraft.
Don't E R Europe T test aircraft too?
Not in the L band, apparently. Hey, we got an empire to maintain. Yeah, we got our test our aircraft. Or we, I should say,
it.
The U.S. government. I kind of get a little, you know, when people say we. I mean, it's not we that's doing all this.
When I think of the U.S. government, I don't think of myself anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't say we're bombing Afghanistan now. I don't have anything to do with that. I mean, that's the U.S. government.
F.
We learned last year how little we have to do with that.
Yeah, exactly.
F-U. N. Funny. How. Every. Thing. Is. T. I. Tied. Up. To. No, T. O. Together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny now. I mean, you can see homeless people in San Francisco with little American flags sticking up from their shopping carts and walking around. It's just kind of strange times we're living in right now.
In this is the F. I first time I have H heard about the PE Pentagon owning or controlling that
the
band?
L band. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's covered in my book. They do have dibs on the L band, and they won't give it up supposedly for commercial broadcasting or any kind of public broadcasting.
I have B E Ben T A talking about what I call the Combine plot for like 30 years. Well,
what's the Combine plot?
Well, he came up with the Combine from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The main character talks about this Combine where everybody is hooked together in their brain. So if they kind of behave or think in a certain way, they get this charge. That was his like whole kind of thing. Yeah. That was his craziness that he thought that. So that's where Frank got the word Combine.
Uh-huh.
And he would talk about it as this kind of, overlay on everything. This is like, before anybody was thinking like this, at least as far as I knew, that kind of controlled everything. It controlled the way people thought and the way what people were willing to do and not willing to do in a very automatic kind of way without thinking.
So if they thought the wrong thought or something, they got an electric shock?
Well, not literally. I mean, in Frank's case, it wasn't literally them getting an electric shock, but, there's like the whole kind of thing of taboo, what's okay and what's not okay. Like people just knew what was not okay to do. So they had internalized the electric shock. Yes. Yeah. Right? Is that right? Yeah. When I first started talking about it, well, when he first, he would turn to me and say, tell them what I mean by the Combine, and I would tell people and I'd see this kind of glaze go over them, like, what are they talking about, And then, eventually and gradually it got, to now where, it seems like everybody, or a lot of people we run into anyway, are thinking in terms of this power structure that controls everything and everybody, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was reading in an Amnesty International report. They've got these these punishment belts that they use on prisoners now. Where if prisoner does something a guard doesn't like, a guard can press a button and it'll send a electric shock through the prisoner's body. So I mean, and that's just one example of the technology is getting so formidable right now that it's really lends itself to the some pretty spooky possibilities.
Well, one of the things you would talk about with the Combine is the way people, he said, who is the Combine? It's all of us. It's like, that mm-hmm. we're all doing it. It's the censors, it's the politicians, it's the women's mm-hmm. libbers. It's like everybody who thinks that they're right about something mm-hmm. and thinks that what the other person is doing isn't okay. And so it's like the liberal people think that this liberal group isn't doing an okay mm-hmm. thing, and so they think it's okay to censor them or to judge what they're doing, and that mm-hmm. was the way the Combine works. It works like within. Or B, you buying into the numbers game. Is the way the Combine works. So everybody's thinking, well, why should I bother starting up my own station? I'll only get 5 people listening. It's not worth it.
You mean the people in the Combine can censor each other?
Well, he just the way the Combine works is that people kind of like the way you're thinking, you're kind of you're censoring yourself. So yeah, somebody who would think it's not worth it for me to start up my own station because nobody's going to listen because it's too small. I won't reach enough people. And so that's like, so that effectively has stopped that one voice from speaking. And, you know, you don't know how many people would be reached by that one guy having his little micro radio station or this SH show is MU much M much to L O long. That people would think it's much too that it's too long to have a show that goes 2 hours or more. Mm-hmm. Like, so you kind of have internalized that there's a certain length of time that's okay.
Yeah.
30 minutes is about the right amount of time to have a talk show.
Mm-hmm.
H, an hour at the most.
I find an hour to be too short. Every week I find after an hour I'm...
Yeah, he wants to go to 2 hours.
Yeah, I'm always running out of time before I run out of what I planned to do.
So many people are like they kind of have to shift that they can actually like sit here and talk, you know, that we don't have to kind of like, you know, move it along. Oh, that picture there is from the Art Institute in Chicago. And they had invited Frank to be a visiting artist and... You know, you got to speak to the artists in the auditorium, and we didn't know who they were. They called us. They offered them money, you know, and they'd fly us out there. So we don't care who they are. We said, sure, you know. And then we get there, and we find out it's this major institution. But what happened was they told us when we got there that he should do an hour and a half or something, 2 hours. I forget, 1 hour. And... He said, why do I lose the space in an hour? And they said, no. We just find that that's people's attention span, that people will start leaving after an hour. And he said, well, I don't really care if people leave. You know, how long do I have the actual space? They said, well, you know, you have the space as long as you want it. You know, he said, okay, great. So he made an announcement at the Bistro. The place was packed. He made an announcement that the good stuff was going to happen after most people left. Nobody left.
Nobody
it went
left.
Like 3 hours, you know. And they're like, you know, sitting, the people that run the thing are sitting there like, you know, how did he do this? How did he get people to stay over an hour? But it's that kind of, you know, pressure. You know, it was like, it was kind of heavy that he was like asking those kind of questions. It wasn't okay. You know, you should have just kind of said, okay.
Yeah. So what was that presentation like?
Well, he told them to quit art school and follow their own vision. He had Michael does this all this art here, this kind of fine stuff.
Uh-huh.
And when Michael went to art school, they told him he couldn't draw, and he believed them. So he spent 10 years thinking he couldn't draw. And then he hooked up with Frank, and Frank didn't know he couldn't draw. And Michael does graphic design as his job, and Frank, graphic design, you know, draw some posters.
Mm-hmm.
So we found out years later when we were sitting around, and Frank said, years into it, when did you first realize you could draw? Thinking he'd say when he was like 12 or 13. He said, I think it was when I did that third big project for you. So we told all the students that. We had Michael's art up along the wall and the flyers that he's done. And everybody had been admiring it before the lecture started. So after Frank told them about the good stuff happening after everybody left, he had me tell them this story about Michael.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, just quit art school and follow your own vision.
Mm-hmm.
That was,
that's great.
Yeah. Well, it's 10:30. 2.5 hours. So are we wrapping? B E T T better or you will have problems fitting it on BTV? No, is that it? No, you will. Yeah. The BTV show, the Berkeley Public Access show, is 2.5 hours. When a show goes over 2.5 hours, I start getting nervous because I'm the one that has to, like, fit it on the tape. And I don't like to cut anything out. I like to kind of keep everything in there.
Well, listen, it's really been fun being here. It's really, really nice to meet you.
Yes, you too.
See your
definitely. Thanks for having us.
Set up here.
Yes.